Good evening, everyone. Thank you for being here. My name is David Fisher. I'll be your moderator tonight. Welcome to the sixth season of Airtime, presented by AIR, Arts Incubator of Richardson, in partnership with the Alamo Drafthouse Cinema in Richardson, Texas. Airtime is a signature artist interview series featuring artists and creative thinkers in Richardson's and the Dallas-Fort Worth area, where artists share about their art and why their creativity makes a difference. Airtime is funded in part through the generosity of Eric Wise with WealthStar Advisor and through a grant from the City of Richardson Cultural Arts Commission. It is February 10th, 2016, and today's creative guest is Jimmy Wallace. Jimmy Wallace is an absolutely. Jimmy is an Oak Cliff native, operator of the Dallas International Guitar Festival, and owner of Jimmy Wallace Guitars. But before I sort of read out the bio that I had, I'd like to introduce his son, James Wallace, who is going to introduce him and maybe tell a story or two.
Yeah, it feels weird to, just pretend you're not there. My name is James Wallace. I'm actually the creative director and programmer here at Alamo Drafthouse. It is weird to introduce your dad. I think we've had a lot of great guests and good movie pairings, but I think this is a really good one, and you'll find out why. To give you some perspective, I spent my summers in my dad's recording studio, which was in Sunnyvale, Texas. And I remember walking up and down the halls, and as in most recording studios, those kind of framed platinum and gold records kind of adorn the walls, the ones that they send you when a record does really well. And I remember Johnny Winter, who I only knew to be this really pale guy that was really good at guitar. And the coolest one I thought at the time was Vanilla Ice, had recorded his debut record there. Didn't have good taste in music at the time, please forgive me. And then I remember every time I walked up and down that hall, I saw this image, and I had no idea what it was. But it just stuck in my mind, and it was of this guy. And he had these black cowboy boots on, and this kind of olive green suit, big cowboy hat, sunglasses, and a newspaper. So true stories. And it always stuck out in my mind. It's this kind of, you have that iconography from your childhood, and it just resonates with you in a way. And so I grew up, and I kind of came into my own with music, and I discovered the Talking Heads, and they very quickly became one of my favorite bands. And then when I was in film school, I saw a film that was way ahead of its time. If it played at Sundance today, it would win all the awards. It was kind of the indie quirky comedy before that was even a thing. And that was, of course, True Stories, the film you're going to be watching tonight. And then come to find out, those images, that was the poster for the film. And so I started talking to my dad, and he was telling me all these stories about David Byrne and the Heads recording at the studio and being in town and shooting the movie. And here we are. We are days away from opening our new Dallas location, which if you haven't been down yet, I encourage you to come down and see it. It's the first movie theater in downtown Dallas in 16 years, and it is quite an accomplishment. Not just for Alamo, but for the DFW film community and arts community at large, and just the whole resurgence that's kind of going on in downtown right now. And we have this kind of wall of fame in the theater with posters of Dallas-made movies. And just today, one of those posters that got hung on the wall was the True Stories poster, an original True Stories poster. And so it's like this thing that I can't escape no matter where I am. That image has always followed me, and I just love that movie, and my dad has so many great stories about it, and it was weird because I had to go to North Park Mall yesterday, and I walked in and the Talking Heads were playing in North Park Mall, so it feels like the kind of cinematic stars are aligning here, and anyway, I'll let you guys take it away, but thanks for coming, and this is super fun. I'm super excited. So.
Thanks, James. So just as a little
His
bit
real name's Jamie, by the way. It's not James.
I told you not to tell him.
So just as a little bit of a shameless plug off topic, in the previews, which I always adore the previews. The previews that they do for the movies every night are really outstanding. But there was a plug for It Happened One Night. And speaking of downtown movie theaters, the Majestic is one of the buildings I work with. And the Majestic, while not going back to being a movie house, is starting to play movies. And this Saturday, they're going to be playing It Happened One Night for Valentine's Day. I think it's at 5 or 5:30, so check out if you can. So back to airtime and Jimmy. Jimmy, you have been part of the music scene in Dallas for years and years and years and grew up in Oak Cliff and played with the Vaughn Brothers as well as legends like Mick Jagger and Keith Richards and the Cars and Greg Allman, and there's a whole list here. Tell us your perspective of the music scene in Dallas.
Well, I think Dallas has always been a really wonderful place for a musician. Hello? Leland, get up here. Yeah. Is this thing on? I don't think it's on. Is it on? No.
Yes, on.
Is it on now?
Yes.
You know, I think, it's like James Brown. I think, you know, I think Dallas has always been, you know, a wonderful melting pot for musicians because there's always been every genre of music, you know, birthed out of here. I mean, Texas swing, you know, punk. I mean, the whole Deep Ellum scene, whether you look at Deep Ellum as, you know, the youth of Deep Ellum or the, you know, origins of, you know, blues, real blues, you know. And so Dallas is kind of been one of those cities that just embraces everything, which is a wonderful place to live, you know. So, and I think it's still that way. You know, the economy sadly affects music in a great way. But I think the heart of music and the intent and the bands that come out of here still have that passion that's always come out of Dallas, you know?
Now, so much music and so many famous music people have come out of Oak Cliff. What was going on in Oak Cliff in the middle of this century that has made so many great people, and yourself included, come out of Oak Cliff?
Well, I think we did have good water in Oak Cliff. We didn't have the water problems that seem to plague some of the cities up north now. You know, we have southern water. So, you know, yeah, the church that I grew up in was Glen Oaks Methodist Church. And so my first real introduction, eye to eye, with guitars and amps and music was they would pull the seats at this, you know, Methodist Church, Glen Oaks Methodist Church, and they'd have a sock hop on Friday or Saturday. And the bands they would book there were Jimmy Vaughn was in The Gentleman with a guy named Steve Metter, who passed away years ago, who was just this Jeff Beck amazing guitarist. And so, you know, and Steve, I went to Carter, some guys that went to Carter here tonight, I see him, but Micah and Berlin. But Stevie went to Kimball, and so he was in this band called the Brooklyn Underground, which was some Carter guys and Kimball guys. You know, and he played through this little Sears Silvertone amp with a little bitty three-quarter size Gibson guitar, and he and I are the same age. And so I thought, you know what, that's what I want to do, you know. And so that was really the whole, you know, inspiring atmosphere that was going on. And at that church sock hop, tons of famous people play there, you know. But aside from that in Oak Cliff, what most people never look at, which was just as huge, at the same time at Adamson High School, which there's a guy named Johnny Ligon who I thought was going to be here. Sadly, he has cancer and he can't make it. But his dad was assistant principal at Adamson High School. Now, in the same year at Adamson, a couple of years older, was Michael Martin Murphy, Ray Wally Hubbard, and B.W. Stevenson, all in the same class. But people don't, you see what I'm saying? So it was not just this rock, rhythm, and blues thing that comes from the Vaughn Brothers and all the guys. I mean, there's some other amazing guitarists out of Oak Cliff as well. You know, a guy that played with Freddie King for years, Butch Bonner, came out of Oak Cliff. And interestingly enough, the first time that Stevie Ray was recorded, he was in this band called the Cast of Thousands, and they did this album in Dallas called A New High, and it was a kind of a play on getting high in high school. And so our band, The Mint, great name, right, had two songs on it. Steve, the band Stevie was in, called Cast of Thousands, had two songs on it. So all these Oak Cliff bands each had 2,000. The album goes for $500 to $1,000 now if you can find one. But the cool thing, the singer in that band that Stevie was in, was a guy, Jamie, you want to say who it was?
It was Stephen Tobolowsky, Needle Nose Ned from Groundhog Day, but he also co-wrote True Stories with David Byrne.
It's the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon thing. It's constantly just, you know, connecting. So that's a long answer about Oak Cliff.
That's great.
But there's tons of other stuff.
Now, what was it that attracted you to the guitar over the drums or piano or other instrument?
I have no idea. I don't know. I mean, yeah, it's interesting because I'm left-handed, and so, but I play right-handed, and that's just how I picked it up. And you know, there's all the drummer jokes and everything. I just never. I mean, you'll think this is funny. You know, I've owned some form of recording studio for the past 40 years of my life, and I bet I hadn't sat behind a set of drums twice. I just don't. It's not my deal. So I don't know the answer to that. No, Tom, come on, man, really. But I don't know. I love the. To me, guitar is the electric guitar, whether it's jazz or blues or whatever it is just a passionate instrument, you know.
So speaking of electric guitars, as I was preparing for this, I learned a lot about them. So who was Les Paul, and why is his name on all of these guitars?
You know, I didn't bring a Les Paul. I guess I should have, but I kind of brought what I'm into at the moment. But, you know, Les Paul was a pioneer. Really, he's amazing off-the-charts guitarist, but his real, you know, influence on music that will never, ever, ever, ever go away was his contribution to multi-track recording and electronics of guitars and everything. He essentially was one of the pioneers of multi-track recording. He invented a guitar pickup out of the needle that he stole off his mother's phonograph, you know, and he would go put his ear to a railroad tie and hear the vibrations, and he sought out why that happened, because strings, it's from vibration, you know. And so that's his real, you know, aside from some, he's everybody's hero, but aside from, you know, his influence as a great musician, you know, his contribution to the recording industry is amazing, you know.
So tell us about your early bands and your early, when was your first big break? What was your first great gig?
I'm still kind of waiting for that big break. I mean, there's been moments that have been huge that, you know, I can honestly say that I have gotten to play be in the presence of pretty much every one of my childhood heroes, you know. And
they were?
Todd Rundgren, Eric Clapton. I loved Jimi Hendrix. I never was a big Hendrix guy, so no, I never met Jimi Hendrix. But, you know, not only through the guitar show, but just playing, you know, I played with a guy for years that's passed named Bugs Henderson, who was just an amazing, amazing guitarist. And so when we were on the road, we got to open for a lot of people and play with a lot of people. And in recording with him, that's when I got to record with Johnny Winter and, you know, a lot of different guys. So it's, you know, I want to say this in the right way. Texas is full of the most famous, unfamous people you'll ever meet. You know, the guitar show, the guitar festival is full. You know, I can name you 10 guys that are going to play the guitar show this year, and we could play a game of show of hands, and like 5 guys would know who they are. But those 5 guys that know who they are, they're like on the level of Jimi Hendrix with them. So that's a lot of what the guitar show is about, is just supporting these iconic musicians, you know. So with me, where's my big break? Back to the original question. My big break is that I have peace of mind. I'm not out of pride, but just, I mean, I got a new bucket list, because I've by the grace of God, I've really been fortunate enough to really complete a lot of the things I set out to do as a kid, you know. So
tell us about the Guitar Festival. How long does it run? What's the structure? How does it work?
This is the 39th year. And I will answer your question, but the guitar show as a concept in regard to where it is today really came out of, you know, a lot of other people's hard work along with me. But, you know, the point it is today, when I was 13, 14 years old, I got to go to a deal at Market Hall that my mom and dad actually let me go. And they dropped me off for 3 days every day with the other guys that were in the band with me. And there was an event at Market Hall called Flower Fair. And how many, does anybody remember that? There you go. Okay, Kitty remembers.
I'm dating myself.
Okay, and at Flower Fair was Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels, which was a big deal. And Spencer Davis, when Stevie Winwood was 15 years old, singing Give Me Some Lovin'. Neil Diamond, when he was more looked at as this aspiring young songwriter, you know. The people who did Green Tambourine, that song Green Tambourine. I can't think of their name. The Lemon Poppers, there you go. And so there was this music festival right in the middle of Market Hall, but around it were all these, you know, lifestyle type businesses. Arnold & Morgan, a place that I worked for a good many years, had a booth there, and Melody Shop, and, you know, a lot of the Dallas music stores had booths, and then the Electric Rocking Horse, which was like a clothing boutique that was one of the first places that sold bell bottoms, you know, and there was this, it was Flower Fair, it was this hippie type thing, but it was just the culture, it was a lifestyle, and I never ever forgot that. And Danny Eaton, who is one of the main executives with Live Nation, who I know, you know, Danny Eaton probably, you know, he was one of the promoters of that, like right out of high school, you know. I think he and Mark Lee, I could be wrong about Mark Lee, but I think they put it on. And I've never forgotten that event. And Danny and I have talked about it before. So that's where my heart for Market Hall lies, because I sat there for 3 days, watched those bands down on the end in the freeway hall. They had local bands in a battle of bands. And nobody ever emulated it again in this. And that's when we started the guitar show from coming, you know, the place where it was not just like the gun environment of buy, sell, trade, but to where, yes, that element's there. And it's just everything that celebrates the guitar. It's buy, sell, trade. It's, you know, it's a clinic over here. You know, it's the acoustic stage. It's the two main stages, you know. And so that's kind of where we... how we got to today, and I know this is the 39th year, so what the heck.
That's a great legacy. Tell us about the most famous or most valuable guitar you've ever sold, touched, or brokered.
When I was, I'll tell you a story that's interesting, has that, whether I answer your exact question or not. So, when I was still playing with Bugs Henderson, I got a call from Eric Clapton's guitar tech at the time, and he said, and Jamie Oldecker was still playing drums with him, and I'd become friends with Jamie Oldecker. From Tulsa, and Tulsa kind of had their own Oak Cliff version of a music scene with Leon Russell and all the guys from Carl Radle from Clapton's band at the time. And he called me, he said, man, you know, Eric's looking for, you know, some 50 Strats, and he heard you've got some, and, you know, Jimmy Oldecker told me, you know. And so I... at that time, the first year of a Stratocaster was 1954, and now a 1954 Stratocaster would go for well over $100,000, you know, in original condition. And I had four of them at the time. You know, they were maybe $10,000 at the time. And I had four of them, but I had a black 56, which is like his Blackie, which you would think black wouldn't be a rare color. It was incredibly hard to find black 56, 57, 58. And so I had one totally original condition, so I brought it out there for the heck of it, because I thought he'd get a kick out of it, you know? And so so I get there, and he comes down, he's very personable, he's very nice, and he plays the 54s, then I open up the case to the black 56, and he says, because he said he wanted a 54 first year. But 54s have a really big neck, and then they changed the neck to 55, and he says, I'll take that one. I said, well, that was not for sale. I just brought that for you, you know, to look at, because I thought you'd get a kick. I'm still thinking normal, you know? And you're not dealing with somebody that's mentally, look, the guy's awesome, but he, ever since he was a teenager, I'll tell you a rabbit trail once. Jimmy Oldecker told me once a story where he said Clapton kept seeing everybody use these pieces of plastic to pay for things, you know, when credit cards first come out. And he says, well, I want one of those. And so they thought, oh my gosh. So they give him a credit card and they said, okay, Eric, this is good for $3,000, right? So in his mindset, he was hugely into cowboy boots and cowboy shirts at the time. So he goes into Shepler's here in Dallas and he spends $3,000. So he has the chauffeur take him to the next place and he plops it down, it's declined. You know, he's like, they told me this was good for $3,000. He thought it was good for $3,000 every time you spend it. So now that's the mindset of this guy sitting here that I'm telling, well, that one's not for sale. Things just aren't not for sale, you know? And so he was cool with me. And I said, you know, that's my own personal guitar. And I was huge, I still am a huge Clapton fan. And so I said, but would you sign it? And he was still upset. So he pulls out this key to the car he was driving. It was a Mercedes key, you know. And he scratches EC, I'm fine with it, scratches EC in the back of it, just like EC was here, you know. And he goes, and he hands it back to me like, kind of spoiled, like, if you're not going to give it to me, I just, you know, he didn't try, because the guitar then, and I wasn't getting him to do that because I wanted to, you know, increase the value of the guitar. It was just, you know, he's Eric Clapton, you know. And so that's an interesting guitar story. In answer to your question, there are, in the guitar business, some of the holy grails are the original Flying Vs and Explorers, and there's 37 original Explorers, and I've had the privilege of owning two of them, not just to broker, but for long periods of time. So I'm not going to say what those went for, but, and there were close to 100 Flying Vs, and I've had three of the Flying Vs. And let me put it this way, you can buy a house with one of those guitars right now. Even in this economy, you could buy a house. So I've had five of the 137 Holy Grail guitars, and here's the point. I've had the privilege of, you know, broken guitars because I love guitars, but my passion for guitars is still to find a guitar that really inspires me to play. To me, that's the purpose of a musical instrument, is to inspire you to make music with. You know, it's not supposed to be something that, you know, you make money with, although thank God that's how I made a living. But it, like this guitar back here, are we okay?
Yep. No, actually, that's okay. Where I was going to segue right into you. I know you brought two guitars. It's not a concert, but I wanted him to sort of demonstrate the different sounds between two different guitars and actually talk about what makes a guitar unique.
So with where I'm at now, it's because, you know, I really have enjoyed having a lot of the famous guitars, and so now, you know, a real trend now is to find the most beat up guitar you can find that's a great instrument. You know, I mean, you pay extra money now for somebody to quote unquote relic something, you know, which before it was like, I want the most pristine, clean instrument you can. So I was just at a show in Philadelphia, and this guy, you know, I'm not going to show you the back yet, he brings this to me and he said, are you interested in this? All the parts are straight, you know, and he's thinking nobody'd ever play it. And so I look at the back, you know, and it's missing all the finish and all this stuff. And he said, you know, this thing was in Katrina, you know? And I said, I just try to be cool. I said, okay. And so I bought it and started taking it apart and had green oxidation, like when things are underwater and everything. And so all the electronics are totally stock. Everything on it's totally stock, except for one pot froze up. So we're trying to rebuild that pot now, the potentiometer here. The back pickup had a low output, so I put one on my pickups. We do pickups now, and in here, and I'm having that pickup fixed. But this guitar, aside from all the wear and the finish that peeled off as a result of being underwater, it's totally together and it sounds amazing. The amp's not on. So I'm really getting a kick out of just finding stuff that some people, you know, people have really kind of kicked aside. And, you know, because think of the history of this guitar. Like, that wear is normal. This is where it came off from being underwater here. But somebody made some serious music on this guitar for that much wear to be opening. And that's inspiring to me, to be playing something that somebody, you know, played that much.
I thought you were going to say it was going to be B.B. King's, and you knew it because you sold it to him. And
no, that's a fun part of the business, but and a lot of that's gone on. But and there's guys that, you know, Heritage Auctions is a huge sponsor of the guitar show, and thank God they are. You need to get that.
Nope.
It's a joke. And so, you know, that element of the guitar business has definitely helped the economy of the guitar business, the, you know, the collectibles and on and on. But it's, you know, I just love guitars. You know.
So can we get the amp on and play a few bars?
So you mentioned B.B. King. So this definitely is the kind of guitar that B.B. and... you know, Freddie played. It's a so it's an ES-335. Do y'all know what ES stands for? Electric Spanish. It's really complicated. Seriously. And this is an ES-335, and B.B. King and Freddie King played 35s, 45s, and 55s. And so I'm looking for a pick. And, well, I won't use a pick. So it's, these guitars, Kitty wanted to know the difference in why guitars. So this guitar still has... It still has an electric sound, but it's still kind of got a, you know, I've got to put it in my pocket. Well, maybe I don't. I thought I did. Oh, there it is.
We've got one over here.
Oh, I can't use your pen. It was a joke. No, it was a joke. So, so that's the rhythm pickup. That's the treble pickup here, okay? But a guitar like this, you can roll it back and you get a much more, get a mellow sound. And this is a Gibson Firebird. My son likes Johnny Winter, so I thought I'd bring a Firebird. So Johnny Winter, we had the privilege of having Johnny Winter at the guitar show about a month before he passed away. And so this one has a little more twangy sound, you know. So if I turned it up, it would, you know. You know, so this is a solid body guitar, so it'll have a little more edge to it. And I mean, I could have brought a Strat and the Fender guitars and stuff, but we would have been here a long time. Is that enough?
Yeah, sure.
Can I be in the band?
You can be in the band, yes. You're hired. So, I mean, as I was thinking about the development of music and the development of guitars, and so, I mean, obviously, these are technological instruments, but in terms of comparing them to the instruments of today with synthesizers and computers, and you hardly need humans anymore to actually make music, how do you think, what is the place of guitars and guitar-driven bands these days?
Well, that's kind of like asking why one person's a Democrat and why one's a Republican, but, you know, I'm not a fan of a lot of that music, and, you know, I've owned a recording studio for years, and I'm not saying there's not heart behind it, because that's those folks' passion, but I think there is a real resurgence of, it's a long answer to the question you ask, because a lot of the answer is social. It's not just musical, you know. But I think there, regardless of how we got where we are today or why we got where we are today, I think there is a resurgence of kids that want to actually learn to play the instrument and actually want to play it great. It doesn't mean they have to play it like Eric Clapton or Jimi Hendrix or whatever. They get to play it the way they want to play it, but they're more concerned now. They want to go beyond just the expression of good, bad, ugly, frustration, whatever, that a lot of the music of the, you know, 80s, 90s and on brought about. And I think they're going back to, I want to be an excellent musician, which is awesome. You know, I think that's incredible. And I think there's some young guys that are coming up. We do a contest at the guitar show called the Texas 10 Under 20 that James oversaw, you know. And he's so busy here, you know, it's hard for him to be involved now, but he oversaw that for years, and it's a wonderful contest because you see, you know, they say kids are smarter these days. Well, kids are learning how to be amazing at a lot younger age. I mean, there's some, you know, Leland, you know, is back there, who's an engineer at the guitar festival. I mean, Leland, aren't we seeing young kids who are just masterful at 13, 14, 15 years of age? I mean, no, but and you know, and a lot of that comes from, I think, from the fact that you can, you know, music comes from influence. You know, if you and I hang around each other enough, you're going to influence me. I'm going to influence you. And now, you know, my kids, I'm, you know, Jamie's two brothers. You know, they kind of want to play guitar. You know, and one thing I say to them is, as I say, okay, I'll spend time with you, but man, why don't you get on the internet and just look up YouTubes? And Grant, the youngest at 14 years old, is coming in, going, and Jamie and I haven't got a chance to see. He's asking me, he goes, well, now how do you play this Pink Floyd song, and how do you play this Queen song, and how do you play, you know, this and this? So, you know, I think if you take that electronic thing you're asking about and use it and come back to the place where you're going to use the influence of it to really learn to play an instrument again, you know, I think that can be a positive thing. But to really answer your question, I really do think there's kids growing up now that really have a heart to learn to be really great musicians rather than express their frustration with society.
And so what advice would you give one of these aspiring musicians?
Pray that their parents have grace enough to support them. And, you know, my parents were incredibly supportive of me. Always, you know, as long as I, you know, did my best to do what I said I'd do and keep my word. And you know, my parents were unbelievably supportive of everything that I've been able to do. So.
Great, thanks. Yeah. So tonight's movie is True Stories. What would be the one true story that you would like to tell that none of us will believe?
Yeah, tell the rap party story.
At North Park?
Yeah.
Which one?
About Mr. I'm trying to maintain my consistent pain.
Okay. All right, so it's funny he said North Park because I think that's what he wants me to tell. So there was a really cool cast of True Stories. What's interesting is when Steve Tobolowsky was at the studio, I didn't click to the fact that he was Steve Tobolowsky, the guy from Kimball that sang in the band with him. But the director was, her name was Sharon, mm-hmm. and she was like the assistant director of The Hand. Did you know that? Mm-hmm. You know? And so she was there all the time. And so there was this one guy that I became friends with. And so there's the movie's over. They've cut everything. They've filmed everything. And so there's this cast party at North Park. Jimmy mentioned North Park. So this guy I'd become friends with, they'd done a lot of the dialogue and stuff. I just saw him. He was sitting by himself. Nobody paid any attention to him. He wasn't famous. And he was a big guy. So we're sitting on North Park, the place where the round thing is, the kind of pool with, when they're like.
There used to be penguins.
Okay, yeah.
And now there's, I don't even know if it's there anymore. There was penguins and then there was ducks.
Yeah. Do you have a cold? You sound like you have a cold. Do you need to take some medicine?
No, this is my microphone voice.
I was trying to be a dad. So I come up and I sit next to this guy and I said, "How you doing, man?" He goes, "Well, you know, I'm kind of glad it's over," but he said, "You know, if this thing doesn't work out, I'm going to have to go back to, you know, carpentry. I'm a carpenter by trade, you know." And I said, "Oh, really?" I said, he goes, "Yeah." He said, "You know, I've got one more audition after this." And he said, "I don't really have anything going." He goes, I got to make some money, you know. And that was John Goodman. So is that the story you want me to tell?
It's the best story.
Yeah. And so.
One of the greatest lines in any movie is his line in this movie where he says that he maintains a consistent panda bear shape.
But, you know, in real life, and I'm not his buddy or anything, you wouldn't remember me from that, but in real life, he is that guy. He was that guy the whole time he's in the studio. I mean, one day, the way we got the gig was, is, you know, we were in Sunnyvale, which is a suburb, you know, of suburb of suburbs. And so, we got a call from the company that was scouting the studios, and you know, it was a great studio, a friend of mine owned, Russell Whitaker, Las Colinas, you know, Dallas Sound Live. There was great studios in Dallas at the time. And so they come out and they look at our studio and they pretty much on the spot said, "This is where we're gonna do it." David Byrne came out and looked at it and said, "Okay, we're good." I went, "Wow," you know? And they picked it because it was remote. It was out, it wasn't in the normal, you know, Dallas traffic, the whole bit, and so, one day they're coming in, and each day they would come in at whatever session was going on, and they would ask what everybody wanted for lunch, you know. And you could say you wanted anything you wanted for lunch, and pretty much they'd go get it. So they were cutting a track that had a steel guitar on it, and that guy was in there with and John Goodman was in there, and the guy, I think his name is Tommy Maloney, passed away now, but he said, "I can ask for anything." And they said, "Yeah, whatever you want, you can have." He goes, "Have you ever seen them sausage on a stick at 7-Eleven? He goes, "I want two of those." And John Goodman goes, "I'll take four." And so that's one of my John Goodman. And they went to 7-Eleven and got some sausage on a stick.
All right, so we always finish up airtime with our top 10 questions. So this is the speed round. Okay. So I'm going to ask you 10 questions, and you just give me the first answer that comes to your mind. Number one, your favorite flavor of ice cream?
Vanilla.
Number two, the one musician you would most like to have had the opportunity to jam with, but didn't?
Les Paul.
Your favorite city in the world?
Dallas.
One movie that everyone should see at least once in their lives?
Hunt for Red October.
What was your very first car?
67 Malibu.
Who do you want to sing or play at your funeral?
Can't say yourself.
All my friends.
How do you take your coffee?
I don't like coffee.
What is the longest trip you've ever taken on a bus?
I don't know. I can't remember.
The one place you'd like to travel to that you haven't been to?
Hawaii.
And what is the favorite guitar in your collection?
the 1968 black Les Paul custom, black beauty custom that my mother bought me with babysitting money that I still have.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Jimmy Wallace, thank you.
So I kept dropping hints, and we don't have a time for Q&A, but you're not getting out here without telling. You think I've probably heard all these stories a million times, but there's some stories I haven't heard. But I'm genuinely interested in all this stuff, and it kind of crosses over into what I've always loved, which is movies, especially with something like this. But there is one story that I've heard a lot, and it never gets old. You know which story I'm talking about, right?
What? Okay. So, I used to be in this band called Lynx, which was really fun, and it was, you know, it was a really good band. And there was a guy named John Dillon who was on the radio forever, you know, the disc jockey. He was the oldest, he's still alive, FM disc jockey, you know, constantly in Dallas, you know. He had really tried to help me with my career, and a guy named John Kirksey with CBS, and they were about to sign Lynx, and so I get this call from John Dillon, and then Kirksey calls me right afterwards. He was an A&R guy, as I said, with CBS, and he said, okay, we got you an audition with somebody, and I said, who is he? He goes, I'm not going to tell you who it is, because you might not even do it. I said, they just said, just show up like you're going to go play a gig. And I look quite different than I do now. And, you know, they said, just dress in your gig clothes. And I said, do I need to bring an amp and a guitar? He goes, no, they've listened to the Lynx recordings. You've already passed the musical part. And I went, well, wow. And they said, they're really concerned about appearance, you know. And so I go to this quote-unquote interview. It wasn't an audition, it was an interview, you know, to see, you know, if I was the guy. And so I go in there, and there's this lady sitting there, and she looks like somebody's mom, and she has like a dress on, which there's nothing wrong with dresses, but she doesn't look rock and roll, you know. She's kind of reddish hair, and you know, she's sitting at this table, and she's got, and they're English. I could tell their accent was English. And she whispers over, she goes, son, she goes, I'm so sorry. She goes, you don't look like your pictures. What happened? She goes, where's your hair? And I had a full head of hair, and I'm not talking, this was not the issue. And I had just, my hair was about down the middle of my back, and I'd just gotten my haircut about to here. And it was Sharon Osbourne. And Randy Rhoads, sadly, had died, you know, and my hair kind of had the vibe of his, and I kind of played in that, at that time, in that vein where I could have copped it. Now, what he gets, I wouldn't have done that gig anyway, you know. I'm really saying I would not have done it, you know. But you don't want to get rejected because you just cut your hair, you know. But that's...
Well, this is a band that hit the keyboardist behind a curtain because the keyboard wasn't metal enough. So,
yeah.
I mean, it mattered.
And so, you know, I was honored that, you know, I passed the musical part of it without them even, you know. So that the story. So I didn't get even a chance to have that gig because of I cut my hair.
All right. So thank you again, Jimmy. I'll turn it over to Kitty to close this out.
I'll make this very quick so we can stay on schedule. We'll do the drawing after the movie, so please stay for the movie and we'll take care of that then. Thank you to Jimmy and to David and to Jamie. Just on a quick note, the March 16th airtime is going to feature guest artist Mike Shelby, who is the son of automotive designer great Carol Shelby.
Wow.
And the movie's going to be Bullet. And the anticipated car showing out front should include two 2016 Charger and a Mustang, vintage Charger and a Mustang, and a Shelby Mustang. We're doing all we can do to get you back in March. So anyway, enjoy True Stories. We'll do the drawing after the movie. And thank you all for being here.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Yeah, I keep trying to embarrass me by calling me my old family nickname. I'll embarrass my dad. So my dad and I have always had this competitive thing, and I'm talking to him today, and he was like, yeah, so, because I had the honor of doing airtime last year, so I'm talking to him on the phone, and he was like, yeah, so, you know, just trying to be as casual as he possibly can, like, what's the tickets at right now? I said, well, you know, it's good, you know, we try and keep these smaller and intimate. This is in a bigger house than normal because this is a very special 35mm showing this film. I said, you know, it's doing really well. And he was like, well, what was yours at? So I'm happy to report I went and looked at Tigmater and we had exactly the same amount of people. So there we go.
I'll tell you one thing to honor my son and then I really will be quiet. Is we were doing the press party at the, I told Kitty this story. I'll do it quick. We were doing the press party a few years ago, and Joanne Holt, who's a wonderful lady, is our publicist. And we were doing it in Oak Cliff. I'm forgetting the name. It's a real cool place in Oak Cliff by Fort Worth Avenue.
It's a little boutique motel.
Yeah, what's the name?
The Belmont?
The Belmont. We were doing it at the Belmont. Who the owner of that's an Oak Cliff guy, went to Carver, by the way. And so this young guy walks up, and you know, Joanne's a great publicist, and this young guy walks up and she introduces him and said he's a writer for the Dallas Morning News. And so, you know, they come to the press party and they're kind of looking for an angle they can do a story on the guitar show, you know, that's new. And so he's talking to me and, you know, I said, hi, I'm Jimmy. He goes, now is your name James or Jimmy? I said, well, my real name's James. I said, my son started going by James. And he goes, James Wallace? And I said, well, yeah. He goes, James Wallace that does movie reviews and he's written. I said, yeah, that's my son. He goes, I said, he's right over there. The guy didn't even ask me anything else. He just leaves and goes to talk to Jamie. So in that moment, it shifted from, and I'm very, very, very proud of this. It shifted from, yeah, well, Jimmy Wallace is my dad to, yeah, James Wallace is my son. So I am very proud of my son. And he's done an amazing job here.
A lot of love here tonight, and that should continue because how many of you guys have never seen True Stories? Oh, wow. Well, clear some room on your list because you're about to have a new favorite up there. Those of you who have grown up in Dallas and kind of know the sites, you'll see a lot of familiar places. Of course, North Park Mall, which we talked about, Big Town Mall, which was out by my dad's studio. I believe they recorded the talent show sequence either. It may have actually been the Majestic,
I think so.
Or maybe the Force Theater. I think it was the Majestic. Anyway, it kind of all around Dallas, McKinney, Fort Worth, a lot of places that you will recognize. It's really a fun movie, and like I said, just so ahead of its time. If you're a huge Talking Heads fan, there's so many hits you'll recognize and a lot of the new stuff that was new at the time that they recorded at the studio. So thank you guys so much, and come see us in Dallas.
One more thing. Jimmy would be here after the movie to talk.
If you want.
Questions?
If you want. I'm going to question him.
You put him on the spot. He will be.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, guys. Enjoy the movie.